You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Corporate globalization and mergers are creating situations requiring workers and the poor to organize in new ways in order to survive. Many groups are applying the concepts of unionism in creative ways. Mexican workers are between a rock and a hard place, caught between predatory multinationals and corrupt government-controlled unions. Labor journalist David Bacon has been following workers' struggles along the Mexican border. Just south of Texas, democracy faces its hardest test, by David Bacon. Mexico's new national government of Vicente Fox hasn't taken office yet, but it already confronts its thorniest political problem. This challenge comes not from the country's former governing party, the PRI, which lost control of the presidency for the first time in 71 years. Instead, a group of maquiladora workers in the state of Tamaulipas have thrown a spotlight on a growing crisis affecting over 1 million workers, the right to form independent unions and thereby raise wages in 2,000 foreign-owned factories, the maquiladoras. On June 11th, hundreds of mostly women workers walked out of the Duro S.A. plant in Rio Bravo, just across the Rio Grande River from far Texas. In the Duro factory, 700 people make gift bags sold under contract to Hallmark and other large U.S. gift retailers. Duro Bag Manufacturing, a private company headed by Charles Shore and based in Ludlow, Kentucky, also owns 3 U.S. factories. Wages in the Rio Bravo plant average 320 pesos a week, about $35, according to Consuelo Moreno, one of the workers. But Duro employees didn't strike for a raise. They stopped work to force the company to recognize the independent union they had formed themselves. Most of Mexico's border workers actually belong to unions, but not ones they control. Instead, factory managers sign agreements, called protection contracts, in which they make sizable payments to representatives from labor organizations affiliated with the PRI. In return, they operate without fear of labor disruption. Duro has a protection contract with the Paper, Cardboard, and Wood Industry Union. That union is part of the Confederation of Mexican Workers, the CTM, a pillar of PRI support for decades. In the past, the company was always able to buy off our union leaders, always, Moreno exclaims. Yet my daughter had to drop out of school this year because we didn't have the money to enable her to continue her studies. And what my husband and I make just doesn't cover our bills. We can only change things if we have a union the company can't control. With the committee we have now, made up of people from the plant, the company can't buy us off. The old protection system began to break down at Duro last fall when workers in the plant elected a new leader, Eliud Almaguer. Almaguer and a committee chosen by the workers presented the company with a list of basic improvements they expected in a new contract, including a wage increase from 320 to 420 pesos a week. When Almaguer and the committee wouldn't back off, national officials of the old union signed a new agreement meeting none of their demands and expelled him. The company then fired him. That convinced Duro employees to form an independent organization. For 2 months, they chased Tamaulipas Governor Tomas Yarrington around the state, holding up banners demanding Libertad Sindical, the right to belong to the union of their own choosing, when he opened clinics or appeared in public. Middle-aged women, often with their children beside them, confronted police outside the plant and camped out in Rio Bravo's main plaza. They told Yarrington that they wouldn't move until the state labor board granted their union legal recognition. Duro's human relations manager, Alejandro de la Rosa, didn't return phone calls, but told Rio Bravo's local newspaper, El Bravo, that the workers are protesting things that aren't our responsibility. Almaguer says he's a dissident leader, but he was actually removed some time ago, unquote. Spontaneous strikes in the Maquiladoras are not uncommon, and other workers have also tried to win recognition for independent unions. But the upheaval at Duro comes as big shifts are taking place, not only in Mexican electoral politics, but also in its labor movement. Just 3 years ago, a large number of Mexican unions left the old government-sponsored Labor Congress and created a new federation, the National Union of Workers, UNT. That federation is a growing presence on the border. UNT General Secretary Francisco Hernández Juárez met with Yarrington and obtained what he believed was a commitment to give the new union legal status. When Yarrington reneged, the UNT organized a public protest rally bringing hundreds of advocates of independent unionism to Reynosa, a border city near Rio Bravo. The Tamaulipas board hurriedly granted the union its recognition. Hernández Juárez believes that workers will organize more independent unions, especially if Duro workers win a better contract with higher wages. That, he predicts, will create a crisis for Fox. Fox's party, the National Action Party, is pro-business and wants to encourage foreign investment. In states like Baja California, where it has been in power for a decade, the party has discouraged independent unions. Workers at Tijuana's Hanyang factory have been engaged in a 3-year struggle similar to that at Duro. The PAN state government ignored federal court orders protecting the independent October 6 union and suppressed a legal strike at the plant. On June 10th, strikers were even beaten by members of another PRI-controlled union at a government-sponsored meeting to discuss labor rights. On July 2nd, the day when Fox was elected, millions of people voted for change, Hernández Juárez says. They voted for democracy, not for a continuation of the system of protection contracts. They voted for union freedom. Hopes for greater democracy, effective unions, and higher wages on the border conflict with Fox's pro-business orientation. But he will have to respond to people's expectations. He will not be able to maintain the old system. What sense does it make, the union leader asks, that for the first time in history, workers could elect a president who's not from the PRI, and yet they can't elect the general secretary of their own union? Border employers clearly feel the threat, as do those PRI-affiliated union leaders who stand to lose their protected status. They accuse Duro workers of being pawns manipulated by U.S. unions and by the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras, an organization of Mexican, U.S., and Canadian activists who support independent union efforts. After the turmoil began at Duro, El Bravo referred to coalition director Marta Ojeda as a professional agitator and accused Almaguer of being paid to organize the work stoppage. Tamaulipas CTM leader Leocadio Mendoza Reyes accused Ojeda of mounting a, quote, dirty war against the CTM to, quote, destabilize the maquiladoras and scare companies into relocating jobs to the U.S. Cesar Trevino Sanz, president of the Maquiladora Employers Association, CANACINTRA, alleged that a campaign was being directed from Texas to undermine maquiladora development. Ojeda, a Mexican citizen, led a movement in 1994 to democratize a CTM union at Ciudad Laredo's huge Sony plant before becoming director of the Coalition for Justice. She agrees that union members and activists in the U.S. and Canada support the Duro workers, but says that support is based on the idea of international solidarity, not self-interest. The attacks on us come on from fear. The people who have benefited from this system are losing control, she declares. And that was by David Bacon, published on August 15, 2000, titled Just South of Texas, Democracy Faces Its Hardest Test. In their never-ending quest for slave labor, capitalists are turning to the prisons where a growing number of Americans now reside. Prisoners in Missouri are organizing to fight for their rights as workers.
Last month, the Missouri Prisoners Labor Union, the MPLU, called for a boycott of the Colgate-Palmolive Corporation. The boycott is the union's response to the continued harassment of MPLU President Jerome White Bay. White Bay, a prisoner in the state of Missouri, has served several months in the hole for refusing to cease his organizing efforts on behalf of the MPLU. Threats and harassment by prison guards against White Bay continue. The MPLU is a legally chartered union in the state of Missouri, but has not thus far been recognized either by the Department of Corrections or by Colgate-Palmolive, which utilizes prison labor through a contract with the Missouri Department of Corrections. The union is demanding the establishment of a minimum wage for prisoners comparable to that of workers outside the prison walls, the abolition of forced labor and abuse by prison authorities, and the support of a bill of moratorium on all executions in the state of Missouri. The MPLU argues that the chilling effect of the death penalty is the worst of many forms of coercion used to scare prisoners from standing up as workers. The General Assembly of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, will meet over the Labor Day weekend to consider resolutions in support of the MPLU and the boycott. The Seattle Industrial Workers of the World branch endorsed the MPLU's struggle for recognition in October of 1999. The Missouri Prisoners Labor Union also announced on August 14th that it was formally endorsing an international boycott initiated by the Prison Moratorium Project against all products and services produced either directly or indirectly by Sodexo Marriott Services, which is a leading investor in the for-profit prison industry. On March 28, 1998, the French multinational Sodexo Alliance took over the North American operations of Marriott Management Services. The merger made the new corporation Sodexo Marriott Services, the largest institutional provider of food services in North America, with $4.5 billion in annual revenues. According to recent Securities and Exchange Commission filings, Sodexo currently holds investments totaling 11% in Prison Realty Trust, Correction Corporations of America, the world's biggest for-profit prison company. Corrections Corporations of America has a well-documented history of abusing prisoners. At a CCA facility in Tennessee, prison officials delayed taking a pregnant woman to a hospital, allowing her to suffer 12 hours until she died from an undiagnosed complication. The Colorado ACLU filed suit against CCA's private prisoner transport company on behalf of a woman who claimed that members of the all-male transport crew sexually assaulted her repeatedly during her five-day trip from Texas to Colorado. MPLU National Communications Officer Michael Lee stated, "The history of private prisons is rife with abuse. Staff tends to be poorly trained, morale low due to substandard wages, and the minimum standards of service provision mandated by the Constitution are often ignored. This situation directly causes prisoner abuse to rampage within every private facility." He went on to state, "It is the use of prisoner labor at slave wages which is very disturbing, for it attacks the standard of living which organized labor has fought so hard to attain." Student activists at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, successfully pressured the administration into dropping a contract with Marriott after revealing Marriott's substantial holdings and profiteering in the prison industry. "This is a victory in the continuing resistance and public campaign against the proliferation of the prison system in the U.S. It is also a victory for prison workers in that the bottom line of a corporation that profits from the prison industry is now being affected."
The nation's poorest people are also getting organized and hoping to create solidarity with the labor movement in the face of workfare. Mike Thornton spoke with Sherry Honkola of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia.
Sherry, can you let people know about the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the whole welfare rights movement that you are in part spearheading?
Well, we're an organization made up of poor and homeless families, folks receiving public assistance, and folks that have just been downsized. And we're busy trying to organize folks in this country that don't have jobs and are unemployed. And we spend each and every day of our life doing advocacy work in the welfare offices or taking over abandoned buildings and moving homeless families into them. And also we can be found distributing food throughout the neighborhood to feed families.
It certainly strikes me as you're speaking, of course, we've been hearing all the last week or so about what a great job President Clinton is and what a great economy we have and all of that, but the truth of the matter is there are a lot of people that are being left behind. Somebody said to me one time that the economy was something along the lines of a rising tide lifting all yachts.
Right now, folks are being told to try and find a better seat on the Titanic. And the problem is that we're on the Titanic, and so we're trying to encourage people to figure out how to build a raft and how to get off of it.
One of the things that came to my attention was that, according to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, they've had a tremendous increase in people who have been seeking shelter and seeking assistance with food. And what I'm hearing you say, I mean, we haven't even got to the edge of the cliff yet. I mean, we're approaching the edge of the cliff, but the edge of the cliff is coming up really quick for a lot of people, correct?
That's correct. This year, we will begin to see more and more folks who will be sanctioned for not finding employment. It's called the two-year time limit throughout the country. And the problem is that people aren't going to be able to find those jobs because they don't exist. And what we're going to be seeing is more and more women and children roaming the streets of this country because they don't have any money in order to pay their rent. The whole attack on so-called welfare recipients and folks that were living on the dole was really an attack on the rest of workers in this country, and in particular on organized labor. At least when folks were on the dole, they were receiving some sort of assistance in order to survive and weren't used as a cheaper source of labor that could replace other elements of organized labor and other workers that are out there. But now you're going to begin to see more and more workers that are going to be told that they can work for even less and less. And it will further chip away at organized labor in this country if we don't begin to figure out how we're going to deal with it. And in particular in California, there's 2.5 million people that are on public assistance. Those 2.5 million folks are being told that they have to go and find jobs. And I already know that in various different parts of California, there's already high unemployment rates in which people right now can't find employment. I'm really concerned about what we're going to see in this country if we don't begin to organize and get involved in trying to do something about what's going to be facing us in the next year to come.
You bring up a very interesting analysis and perspective of the situation, because so much of what has been done to propagandize the appropriateness of all of this welfare reform has been, of course, to turn the lower-waged working person against the person who happens to be on welfare. And what I'm hearing you say is those people's interests are tied together in many, many ways, correct?
Absolutely. This is going to lower the standard of living for all people in this country, that as long as they can hire a welfare recipient to work for their welfare grant, which is called workfare, or what we call in welfare rights slave labor, they're already beginning to do that in parts of California right now. There's no reason for them to pay union wages. There's no reason for them to pay decent benefits and this kind of thing, because they can easily replace a worker with a welfare recipient. And we don't want to be used as replacement for decent jobs, for other folks having access to decent jobs in this country. So we're trying to form the proper relationships with our other brothers and sisters who are in organized labor and that are part of the working poor in this country, because we know that this thing is just a revolving door and that we've got to do something to call for fundamental changes in this country.
And that was Sherry Honkala of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. Children are the most vulnerable of all workers. Though many people think of child labor as something that only happens in dictatorships overseas, farm worker children in the U.S. are in a similar position, a recent report reveals. Bruderhof Radio spoke with the authors.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
And, of course, the United States has been a pretty vocal and consistent opponent of exploitative child labor in other countries. So if they don't take action on the problems facing child farm workers in the United States, the level of hypocrisy is very apparent and quite high.
During the large anti-globalization protests in Seattle and Washington, D.C. in the past year, one of the most common issues raised by demonstrators was the increasing use of sweatshops and child labor by multinational corporations in the Third World. While the problem of labor standards and working conditions is important and must be confronted on a global scale as the global economy grows, we must be aware that in looking so far afield, we run the risk of ignoring problems closer to home. While America may not have as many sweatshops as Southeast Asia, we do have a large migrant farm worker population whose plight is just as deplorable as any Indonesian in a Gap or Nike factory. Bringing this situation into the spotlight are two human rights reports released this summer that highlight the ongoing struggles of American farm workers, particularly children. Both Human Rights Watch and the Farm Worker Justice Fund say in recent reports that growers, farm owners, and government agencies are extremely negligent in enforcing safety and health regulations on American farms. Furthermore, these two organizations say that laws biased against agricultural workers force them to work longer hours in less safe conditions than non-agricultural workers. Children in particular suffer from this legal discrepancy. The reports allege that pesticide exposure, long working hours, and repetitive motions affect children more seriously than adults. And this problem is by no means minor. By most estimates, there are at least 500,000 farm workers under the age of 18 working in the United States. In today's program, Bruderhof Radio speaks with Lee Tucker of Human Rights Watch, an international human rights monitoring group, and Shelley Davis of the Farm Worker Justice Fund, a Washington-based group that seeks to improve the living and working conditions of migrant and seasonal farm workers throughout the United States. Lee Tucker is the author of a report titled Fingers to the Bone, United States' Failure to Protect Child Farm Workers. The report, released in June by Human Rights Watch, focused on young farm workers in Arizona, but Tucker says the problems she encountered are national in scope.
We knew that there were a large number of kids working in the fields in the United States, and we knew that there was a discrepancy in the treatment of the law regarding child farm workers and child workers in other industries. And so we started to take a look at it. Initially, we just took a preliminary look, and what we found clearly warranted a deeper investigation. And so we spent close to 2 years looking at this problem and then came out with our report, Fingers to the Bone. It's the first time we've done a report looking at child labor in the United States. We've done many reports looking at child labor issues in other countries. But what we found is that in the area of agriculture, the United States is very similar to developing countries in the conditions under which the kids are working.
Shelley Davis of the Farm Worker Justice Fund recently co-authored a report titled The Ones the Law Forgot, Children Working in Agriculture. She, like Lee Tucker, found the use of child labor on farms widespread and alarming.
Tens of thousands of children and teenagers work in agriculture, and they are not provided the kind of safe working environment that young people working in other industries are given. We wanted to highlight the fact that young agriculture workers face significant hazards to their health, and that they don't get adequate legal protection. And that was really the focus of our report. So we looked at the kinds of injuries and fatalities that are suffered, and we also looked at the kinds of legal protections that are given, and compared this to the situations of workers in other industries. And let me give you a couple of examples to make it more clear. In agriculture, which is one of the most hazardous industries in the entire nation, there's an estimated 23,000 injuries each year to young agricultural workers and 100 fatalities. In studies that have compared the kinds of workers' compensation claims filed by young agricultural workers to young workers in retail or fast food restaurants, they found that young farm workers suffer twice as many serious and disabling injuries. So that we know that they're really a significant hazard, a significant risk to their health. So you would think in that situation they would get more protection rather than less. But the opposite is the case. In all other industries, workers can't do hazardous work until they're 18 years old. In agriculture, workers at 16 can do hazardous work, and where their parents own the farm, they can be of any age. And that puts young workers at great risk. We also know that these workers aren't getting health and safety training on the job, so that they're not really prepared to take on tasks like applying pesticides or driving tractors. So they really shouldn't be doing those jobs.
We talk to kids who are working 12 to 14 hours a day, and sometimes even more. During peak harvest season, some kids work 16 hours a day. And it's grueling work, even when they're not working that many hours. Under the best of conditions, it's very difficult, grueling work, whether they're harvesting lettuce or cantaloupe bending over, or whether they're pitching watermelon, which is when they throw a watermelon down a line to get it to the truck. In all cases, it's very difficult work, and it takes place under very difficult circumstances, often very hot temperatures. In Arizona, where we did most of our interviews, kids often were working under temperatures well above 100 degrees, and so they risk heat illness and dehydration, along with a host of other health and safety issues that we document in the report. Clearly, there's a danger for long-term workers. There's a danger of interference with proper growth, because a lot of these harvesting techniques even weeding techniques require repetitive motions of bending over, stooping, and so on.
Almost all agricultural field work is both dangerous and monotonous, not only to children, but to adults as well. Davis explains some of the most common hazards she encountered.
There are a lot of hazards on a farm. One of the biggest hazards for farm workers is just getting to and from work. Farm workers a lot of times are transported in old vans or buses. A lot of times they don't have seats, regular seats or seat belts. So that if there's an accident, the injuries are often very serious. And so one of the leading causes of fatalities among farm workers is just accidents on the road getting to and from work. And the numbers are staggering. In the last year, there have been over 100 deaths, and in the accidents, there would be like 12, 13 people killed at a time because these vans are unsafe and the government isn't requiring them to be adequately safe. So that's one of the biggest hazards. On the farm itself, there are tractors and machinery that also can be hazardous. And a lot of very serious accidents happen because machinery is unguarded or a tractor doesn't have a rollover protection bar on it. So that the kinds of injuries that occur are not things that couldn't be prevented. They're things that would just cost a few extra dollars to make them safe. And I think that's one of the reasons we are so concerned about this. We think that a lot of these accidents and a lot of these hazards are well recognized and could be prevented. Another source of risk for farm workers are the chemicals used on the farms. Pesticides used on farms include chemicals that cause cancer, that cause reproductive harm, and that cause neurological harm. Let me just give you a quick example here. The most common kinds of insecticides used on the farms for fruits and vegetables were developed from nerve gas developed for World War II. So in other words, we know that these chemicals cause brain damage, cause numbness in the limbs, cause aches, nausea. I mean, these are kinds of problems that, unfortunately, we see all too often. And it could be prevented by growers using less toxic or not toxic products. So those are the kinds of hazards. There are also falls from ladders, electrocution, drowning, animals. There are a lot of hazards on a farm. Let me just tell you as an example the case of Jose, because I think in some ways this really shows both the inadequacy of protections and the failure to live up to the requirements that there are. He was a 17-year-old farm worker who came here from Mexico with his uncle to try to earn some money for his family. He was in the United States for 2 months when he was sprayed with pesticides. But because he never got any training, he didn't know that the material he was sprayed with was a chemical. He thought it was water. And so they didn't do anything. And even though he wasn't feeling well, he just went home, went back to the labor camp, slept in those same clothes, went to work the next day. A week later, he was sprayed again, had nausea and vomiting. No one took any concern. No one realized, no one said that it was pesticides he was exposed to. The next day, riding his bike on the way to work, he collapsed and he died. So these chemicals are very dangerous, and workers need training. The growers who use these pesticides have to be sure to keep the workers out of the field. If workers get sick, they have to take them to the doctor. They have to make sure that the doctor knows that what they were exposed to is chemicals, and they have to make sure that they get the right treatment. That's the way lives can be saved.
While pesticides pose serious risks to all farm workers, the risks are particularly acute for children. In 1998, the Natural Resources Defense Council released a report called Trouble on the Farm, Growing Up with Pesticides in Agricultural Communities, a comprehensive report detailing the dangers of pesticide exposure to children. According to the report, quote, children are uniquely at risk from pesticides both because of physiological susceptibility and greater relative exposure. Their bodies cannot efficiently detoxify and eliminate chemicals because their organs are still growing and developing. Lee Tucker elaborates.
The most serious danger is that posed by pesticide exposure. And many of the kids we spoke to reported coming in contact with pesticides. Although that's illegal and growers are supposed to take steps to ensure that no one comes in contact with pesticides when the pesticides are still fresh enough to cause damage, many of the kids we spoke to had, and they reported things including nausea and vomiting, rashes, dizziness, wheezing, very serious short-term effects, and also exposure to pesticide has very grave long-term effects, including cancer and neurological damage.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio. We're broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. Today, we're speaking with Lee Tucker of Human Rights Watch and Shelley Davis of the Farmworker Justice Fund about the plight of child farm workers in America. If you've got questions or comments about this program, give us a call, toll-free, at 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461. Beyond issues like the use of pesticides without adequate safety training, another more legal problem troubles both Shelley Davis and Lee Tucker. They say that existing labor laws discriminate against farm workers, both children and adults, by allowing them to work longer hours without overtime pay. In contrast to non-agricultural occupations, The Federal Fair Labor Standards Act imposes neither a daily nor weekly limit to the number of hours children may work in agriculture. Human Rights Watch spoke with several adolescent farm workers who worked 12 hours a day for 6 days a week, and a few who had worked 14 hours a day. Under current law, there is nothing illegal about employers extracting such long hours from children, unless the work occurs during school hours and the children are under 16. Lee Tucker.
The one thing that we emphasize in the report is the discriminatory nature of federal labor law in terms of farm workers. And I'd like to go into that a little bit. It is a very clear and blatant case of discrimination against farm workers. The Fair Labor Standards Act offers differential protection to workers depending on whether they're farm workers or work in other industries. And that's true for adults and for children. Obviously, for the purposes of this report, we were just looking at children. But children working in the field can begin working at younger ages and can work for longer hours than kids working in all other occupations. And at the same time, agriculture is the most dangerous occupation open to children. Child farm workers, children working in agriculture constitute 8% of children working in the United States, but they account for 40% of work-related fatalities among children in the United States. It's very dangerous, not just the pesticides and which we discussed, but also heavy equipment and machinery and knives and so on. It's a very dangerous industry. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, children can begin working in the fields at the age of 12. Under very limited circumstances, they can work even younger than 12, but they can start working at the age of 12. In all other areas, children have to be at least 14. So they can start 2 years younger. And in all other areas of work, for example, at a fast food restaurant, or at a warehouse, as you said, any other place of work except for newspaper delivery, basically. Children are limited during the school year to working 3 hours on a school day and 18 hours total during a school week. Well, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's no similar restriction on children working in agriculture. So you can have a 12-year-old who works, 3 hours before school and then 5 hours after school, and works a total of 40 or 50 hours a week during the school year. That would be completely legal under our current federal law. The only restriction is that children younger than 16 should not be working during school hours. That's the only restriction. And then in the summer, in all other fields, in all other areas of work, children are limited to 40 hours a week, but in agriculture there's no limit. And so you can have kids, and we talk to kids who work 70 or 80 hours a week during the summer. And, of course, that just exponentially increases their risk of injury, their risk of pesticide damage, their fatigue, the risk of musculoskeletal disorders as they grow. And during the school year, the fact that there's no limit on their hours contributes greatly to the high dropout rate among farmworker kids, which is 45%. Only 55% complete high school.
I think this is a legacy from the time when working on a farm was viewed as the most healthy and safe environment that one could be in. And in part it was because people worked on their family farms, but also in general because farms were smaller and so the personal connections between the workers and the owners was greater. Now, a lot of farms, the majority of farms that employ hired farm workers, are large corporate farms, so that there could be thousands of workers on the farm, and they don't have any connection to the owner. And that breaks down the kind of concern and care that employers exercise, unfortunately.
But changing the way young farm workers are treated will take some doing. Lee Tucker of Human Rights Watch encountered strong resistance from farm owners while speaking with young farm workers and researching her report.
Well, with some exceptions, farm owners generally don't like to have outside people talking to their employees. And for our utmost concern always, of course, is the safety of the children. And for this study, I talked to all of the children off-site. I didn't interview any of the kids actually on the farm. Many of the children I spoke to had stopped working in the field and were reporting to me their experiences of the previous year or of a few months earlier because they were no longer working. Also, we protect the confidentiality of all the children we talk to, and we don't use any photos that would demonstrate the identity of the children. This is all to be extra cautious that they would not run any risk. But the growers generally don't like to have outside people coming onto their farm. In fact, I was I went up to an area west of Phoenix, Arizona, where there is a very large, very prominent, and well-known grower who, for liability purposes, I could not name in the report. But and I spoke to a couple of girls who had worked for that very large, very well-known grower, and they reported the same kinds of health, safety, and wage violations that the other children had: pesticide exposure, sexual harassment, being cheated on their wages, etc. Well, in the process of being there and talking to them, the workers for the grower, in other words, not the farm workers, but like the supervisors, found out that we were there and came and ran us off the land and were very threatening to the workers and their parents that we had been speaking with. And it's not uncommon to get that kind of reaction, which, of course, only adds to one's concern that the workers really are being treated unfairly and not in accordance with the law, because there's often such a great fear and reluctance on the part of the growers to be open and transparent with reporters and other kinds of investigators.
Compounding the problems of farm workers is the fact that many are recent immigrants from Central America. With limited knowledge of English and unsure of their rights as employees, farm owners are quick to take advantage of them. Shelley Davis.
The majority of farm workers in this country are legal. They're here legally, but they are from a foreign country. So that by far the majority come from Mexico and Latin America and speak Spanish and aren't familiar with American law. They come here because they want to earn a decent living for themselves and their families. And they're willing to take pretty much any wages that the employer is willing to give them. The result is that over 60% of farm workers live in poverty in the United States. They do extremely hard jobs, work long hours, and yet they get very low wages. The problem facing farm workers, for the most part, is that they're poor, they're immigrants, they're not knowledgeable about their rights in the United States, and they're so desperate to get the work that they're willing to work under any conditions without complaining. And unfortunately, people take advantage of that and put them in the worst possible conditions and don't take adequate concern for their health and safety.
Although prospects for change may look grim, both Davis and Tucker think their reports could have a positive effect in state and federal governments.
I hope that we'll call attention to the fact that there's serious health risks out there. People are really being hurt, and this could be prevented. And in the year 2000, this is a disgrace. And I hope that we can get more safety regulation for young farm workers.
It was very encouraging and unusual that we actually received a very quick response. This report was released June 20th. And I believe on June 22nd, Alexis Herman, the Secretary of Labor, issued a statement acknowledging the need to amend the Fair Labor Standards Act to protect farm worker children equally with other children. And she and Secretary Dan Glickman of the Department of Agriculture have declared that they will work together on this issue, and they support the introduction of legislation by Senator Harkin that would rectify the currently discriminatory language in the Fair Labor Standards Act. Senator Harkin has introduced that legislation before. It was called the CARE Bill, without success. But the Department of Labor and Department of Agriculture now declare that they're behind it. Now, of course, it's unlikely that anything will happen this session. And with it being an election year, It's too early for us to say what the chances would be in the next session. However, we're very optimistic that at least there has been the acknowledgement by the administration that there is unfair and unequal legal treatment of these children and that it needs to be rectified. I should also say that one issue that helps in terms of getting visibility and perhaps getting a response from the administration is the passage last year of a new International Labor Organization convention, Convention 182 on the Worst Forms of Child Labor. And the United States administration was very vocal in pushing that convention through. And, of course, the United States has been a pretty vocal and consistent opponent of exploitative child labor in other countries. So if they don't take action on the problems facing child farm workers in the United States, the level of hypocrisy is very apparent and quite high, because given that they have been using quite powerful language, encouraging other countries to protect their children. So I think that works in favor of greater protection for kids in the United States, the fact that the U.S. has been a vocal critic of other countries.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a look at problems facing young agricultural farm workers across America. We heard from Lee Tucker of Human Rights Watch and Shelley Davis of the Farm Worker Justice Fund. Tucker's report, Fingers to the Bone, United States Failure to Protect Child Farm Workers, can be found on the Human Rights Watch website, www.hrw.org. Davis's study, titled The Ones the Law Forgot, Children Working in Agriculture, can be obtained from the Farm Worker Justice Fund at www.fwjustice.org. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman with additional research and reporting by Ian Bart. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461.
And now for some news on the biotechnology front. A joint legislative hearing on GMO foods will be held on September 13th. Senator Kenneth LaValle and Senator Charles J. Fischillo, Jr. confirmed that they are holding a joint legislative hearing on the 5-year moratorium bill on planting genetically engineered crops in New York State. The hearing will be held September 13, 2000, at SUNY Farmingdale on Long Island. Speakers are to be invited. Those who wish to speak in support of the moratorium should get in touch with Barbara Lee Steigerwald this week and ask to have your expert or yourself be added to the list of invitees. There will be a limited number of invitees, so think strategically. Barbara Lee Steigerwald can be reached at the following phone number, area code 518-458-3121. Her fax number is area code 518-426-6826. According to Ms. Steigerwald, there are many more people asking to speak in opposition to the bill than those in favor of the bill, including the Farm Bureau and Cornell University. The length of the hearing has not been determined. Speakers are needed with credentials who can discuss markets and how GMO-contaminated crops are not acceptable in a growing list of countries and not being accepted by a growing number of U.S. companies, and crop quality quantity comparisons for GE soybeans and corn. use of GE seed to address weed and pest problems when there are cheaper, more benign approaches, environmental impacts, suspected environmental impacts, and a good summary of the research to date. Food differences, including quality, for example, higher pesticide residues for glyphosate combined with lower phytoestrogens, allergens, etc. Human health and environmental unknowns, genetically engineered organisms jumping the species barrier, and the myths that GE crops will feed the world, and the legal issues of GE pollen pollution. Also, a major biotechnology conference has been proposed for January 17th through 19th, 2000, in Binghamton, New York, sponsored by NARES. It's called Exploring Leadership Biotechnology Challenges. NARES is the National Resource, Agricultural, and Engineering Service of the U.S. government. They are calling for suggestions for topics. In a recent Country Folks article, it states that if you would like to influence the content of the conference, to visit their website and fill out the online questionnaire. A link to their website will be placed on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. A national organization called the Farm Foundation is holding their conference in Albany on September 17th through 20th, and a major panel discussion is on biotechnology, and the only speakers are pro-biotech interests. Only Cornell University was contacted for inclusion on the panels. The conference description is on the web at www.farmfoundation.org. And that information is from the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. You can contact the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York at area code 518-922-7937. Mark Dunow, organic farmer and Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, is going to be walking the length of Long Island and through New York City, starting on August 24th and concluding on September 10th. He will start in Montauk and reach the Brooklyn Bridge at 2 o'clock p.m. on September 9th. Dunow is walking to draw attention to five federal acts he promises to sponsor. Number 1. The GEO Food Labeling and Safety Act. There are currently no federal requirements for labeling or food safety testing of genetically engineered food. Genetically engineered food must be labeled so that informed consumers can guard themselves and decide the future of this technology in the marketplace. GEO food must also be safety tested by the FDA under the same protocols already mandated for food additives. 2. Agriculture Sewage Sludge Prohibition Act. Currently, half the sewage sludge of urban America is spread over the nation's farmland. The United States has the most permissive sewage sludge standards in the industrialized world. The EPA allows the application of 267 pounds of lead per acre. 3. The Chemical Sovereignty Act. Tons of food grown with pesticide banned for use in the USA are imported and consumed by the American people every day. The import of food produced with chemicals banned for use in the USA must be prohibited. 4. The National Cancer Registry Act. Currently, 5 out of 10 American men and 4 out of 10 American women will develop cancer in their lifetime. There is no national cancer registry to correlate incidence with environmental causes. Americans need this data. 5. No Involuntary Spray Act. The involuntary spraying of synthetic chemicals by government on people or on their dwellings must be prohibited. If you're interested in learning more about Mark Dunow's campaign, you can visit his website at www.ruralparty.org. AT&T,
Philip Morris, Microsoft, Enron, Citigroup, Bell Atlantic, Anheuser-Busch.
Sprint. These are just a handful of the 66 savvy corporations that have given over $50,000 to both George W. Bush and Al Gore. We don't think there's a difference, do you? We're happy with both candidates, aren't you?
Paid for by billionaires for Bush or Gore. Because government should be by the corporations, of the corporations, and for the corporations. www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
Hey America, Shrub Music presents the unkindest cuts from the Bush campaign.
Begin. Try to see it my way. My name is George, I talk from both sides of my mouth. I can speak in Spanish, or I can act just like a Klansman in the South. We can smirk it out. We can smirk it out.
And you get...
On the campaign, I beat McCain. Buried all the lies that told about me and cocaine. I'm running ahead. My ads are unkind. When I'm in the White House, you can kiss my behind.
Yes, relive scads of negative ads with Unkindest Cuts. It's a cut below.
When I get to the White House, you can kiss my behind. In fact, y'all can kiss it now. Come on, pucker up.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by